John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto. America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depth of the most terrifying imaginations with two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about karmic captivity and questionable quandaries. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of Nick Goroff and J.R. Hamantaschen are voice talents Nick Goroff and Rissa Montanez. Now, get your ticket ready. Take your seat in our Theater of the Minds. And brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is written by Nick Goroff and is performed by Nick Goroff and Rissa Montanez. In it, a man struggles to understand and escape his cruel and bewildering captivity at the hands of strangers who seem to enjoy his torment. Now, without further ado, I present to you, They Will Not Let Me Go.
I don't know for how long I have been held a prisoner here, nor to what ends my captors hold me for. If I had the strength still, I'd have fought them. Heaven knows I try now, but something seems to be consuming me, as I no longer seem strong enough to throw hands anymore. I blame this captivity for my frail state. It's not something I'm used to at all. I found myself at least a couple of times feeling steely grips upon my wrists, forearms, knees, and sometimes maybe all three. Hands grabbing me and forcing me down as I struggle to get free. This strength is uncanny. Almost every time I'm either forced to swallow or injected with some sedative or the like, causing me to effectively black out until I find myself again confined to either a chair or a bed in this room. I've always been a strong and steady man. I'm a shipbuilder, in point of fact. Worked the yards in Philadelphia for years, making my living with steel and rivets. A confidence in my work that was as unsinkable as my ships. I managed to raise three children, and even put two through college with that job. At my peak, my arms were like tree trunks. I could and did a couple of times manage to lift small cars, either showing off friends or co-workers, or to the delighted laughter of my children, who, for a while, thought their dad was a bona fide superhero. I guess all kids feel that way at one point or another. Hopefully. It was important for them, my children, to see me as indestructible. Or maybe it was more important for me. When my youngest, Sherry, was 8, with her 2 brothers, Sam and Oliver, being 12 and 14 respectively, their mother, my wife, passed. Aggressive stage 3 lung cancer. We had both grown up as smokers. The day she passed, I quit for good. But with only one parent remaining, I always thought of it as crucial that my kids know I'm not going anywhere. Now I'm here. Now I'm slowly withering away in this strange living nightmare surrounded by creatures. I call them creatures because though they look like people, I know there's no way they can be. Their faces all change and shift, always presenting little moments of familiarity somehow before switching back again to their generally sour and angry alien faces. These strangers torment me in the strangest ways. They will make day turn to night, and then back again, seemingly at either random or according to some unknown purpose of will, leading me further into disorientation as they make it impossible for me to sleep well or deeply at all. It can be the dead of night in my chamber, my cell, with nothing but blackness pouring in through the locked and solid double-pane window, only for the bright and merciless blaze of direct sunlight to come pouring in the moment I close my eyes. It feels as though I've not really slept in ages. I ask them regularly who they are, what they want, but they never answer in a way that makes any sense. Usually they'll smile with some wicked and forced grin on their face before trying to convince me it's all for my own good. I know what's good for me. I'm a grown man. My diet is not shown much courtesy by my captors either, as at seemingly random times throughout the day or night, a tray of some tasteless and sometimes revolting gruel will be placed before me. In times when I am hungry enough to stomach it, no sooner will I start eating than one of my various jailers will pop by and take it from me, telling me I've had enough. Other times, when the sight and smell of the slop in front of me is too revolting to even think about, they'll sit and insist I must eat, even trying to force-feed me at times. All the while, there are always those dark, fake smiles and non-answers to my questions and demands. Naturally, my most common questions are where I am, how I got there, and when they'll let me go. To each of these, it's simply more false tenderness. Usually before they stick me with needles and inject my body with God knows what for God knows what purpose. I think they're trying to poison me, but I can't be sure. Sometimes, after the drugs, I'll lose consciousness for a while and awake in an entirely different room. It will look the same. It'll have the same basic furniture, a bed, a table or two, and some chairs, but it'll be different. Off somehow, just like the supposed people who run this show. Close, but not quite right. There's music. There's seemingly always music. mostly tunes from when I grew up. They play a lot of Rush, and I hate Rush. Always have. I almost consider it another form of torture, though, thankfully. It's never a full album they play. When I try to express this, my captors, these strange people, will laugh right in my face as though it's funny to them. The ones in red are the worst about it. They show up regularly, always during the daylight. Though the faces change each time, with each of the red-clad interrogators always dressed the same way every time, their processes remain the same. A series of questions. What my name is. Where I am. And always if there's anything I want or need. I tell them I want to leave. That I want to go home to my family, to my career, to my life. At this, they laugh at me again. Always telling me that they'll have to wait and see. After this, they'll almost always force me to drink a foul, bitter vial of fluid, which almost always causes me to pass out. I'm almost positive this is just another method of wearing me down. For what? I do not know. But in the repeating and seemingly random cycles of day and night, and the cavalcade of strangers and imposters who will crowd into my cell, my prison, just to talk amongst themselves like I wasn't even there, and then leave with the incessant music playing, have me certain that they're trying to break me. For what, though, I have no idea. I have feigned cooperation, answering their random and pointless questions in the hopes of making some progress and getting beyond these stale and unpredictable cycles. But with every answer, I'm simply looked at like a fool and patronized before whoever is asking either gets up, leaves, or just disappears. I may have forgotten to mention that part. One moment, I can have one of the red ones, or even just one of the other countless random captors of mine towering over me while I sit or lay in bed, asking their questions and talking nonsense. If I but look away for just a moment, though, they will sometimes just disappear entirely, as though they were never there, only to return or send a replacement sometime later. Other times, while in the middle of talking with one of them, usually when talking about my family, the conversations will just end out of nowhere, with whoever was there just gone. There are other more haunting matters which I am plagued by as well. For what can sometimes seem like mere moments, or other times entire days, I will be free. I'm never sure how, but I will find myself again at home, where I belong, with my family, where I belong. My kids will run and embrace me. I will smell the mechanical, industrial odors of metal shavings, diesel fuel, the lingering scent of a day spent welding. Other times, I'm back with Hannah, my late wife. These are both the best and worst of times. Best in that we're together again. Sometimes with kids, sometimes just by ourselves. Sometimes at our old home. Sometimes out at the lake, where we used to escape to years before with the kids. Those were the best times of my life. And for the time I'm there, it isn't a simple dream. I've had plenty of dreams. These visits are as real as can be. Until they're over. Until I'm back in my cell. This is when the worst of things occur. Because for the time we're together, I know where I am, know who I'm with. It's all very real. But then, in the blink of an eye, I'm back here. I'm back, and I remember watching her go. Seeing as her once beautiful face and body withered to nothing, much as I am doing now. It's like losing her for the first time, all over again, every time. I'll come out of these experiences, these relived memories of mine, and call out for her. Not in the sense that I'm looking for, as I know she's gone by then, but in a fresh hell of mourning and grief, because I know she's gone. It's all just some cruel trick and reminder, probably brought on by all the various drugs they force upon me. I'll call out for Hannah, and sometimes someone will tell me that she's no longer with us. But I damn well know that already. These people, these things, they seem to live for it, chemically inducing my fondest memories in the most lucid of ways, only to tear them away from me, or me from them, just to remind me of what I already know and suffer with. Like ripping open a wound that's almost closed, just to add a hearty portion of salt to it.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Sometimes I'll be sat before a grand spread, with piles of food and drink before me. As I bring a plate or cup or spoon or fork to my lips, however, the feast and portion selected just fail to be. Not that they disappear, though they do that as well, but even after having taken a bite or a sip, there is simply nothing there. As though it were all just a mirage. I am convinced this place is a prison, as I am not allowed to leave. I am convinced the goals of my captors are, at least in part, to drive me utterly and entirely mad. I am convinced as well that if I don't get out of here, if I cannot free myself, that I will never see my children again. That is a fate I cannot accept, however. That is one which I will not accept. I have attempted to escape before, I think. As the days and nights and words and faces and constant music and parade of curious busybodies all blend confusingly into one, I find it sometimes difficult to recall if something in mind is a memory or a plan. But I am somewhat sure that at least once I managed to escape this cell, though whatever broader prison this may be proved obviously to be a separate matter. It was allowed by a matter of sheer accident. One of the Red Ones arrived, as they always tend to do during daylight hours, and was accompanied by one of the regulars who would visit my cell to ply me with drugs and questions. This day, though, feeling a curiously renewed strength and force of will, I refused them outright. All of them. Not one of my captors or tormentors would have the satisfaction of my cooperation that day, and this, as it happened, was all it took for them to make the dire error of actually leaving me alone. My resistance that day won me a reprieve, as both parties practically stormed out of the room, frustrated. I waited then, expecting them to return any moment with more drugs, inquiries, and baffling treatment, but no one came. Hours, I think, passed as I watched the door with passing glances, without anyone so much as peeking in. Looking closer, I realized that in their huffing and puffing on the way out, they had forgotten to close and lock the door. I had a chance then. A chance to escape. To return to my kids. To return to my life. There was no way I was passing it up, and so, rising slowly and with difficulty from the bed in my cell, I shuffled towards the door. My legs and back ached and quivered, almost feeling as though the muscles within it atrophied, likely a result of whatever drugs they'd been pumping me with. Yet, regardless, I pressed through the discomfort and soon was at the door. My eyes had not deceived me, as it was clearly ajar, and slowly, slipping my head out into the hallway beyond, looked up and down, searching for guards of some kind. To my good fortune, there were none. The only indication that anyone was nearby were low and murmuring voices behind a closed door down the hall. I could not tell what they were saying, but didn't much care so long as they stayed where they were. As my legs were so weak, I was forced to hold the wall and whatever odd furniture littered the hallway to support myself as I made my way along. Thankfully, though, this slow and honestly difficult movement helped me stay as quiet as possible, seeking to avoid raising the attention of my jailers. The hallway itself was strange. It looked and felt like some strange amalgamation of the familiar and the foreign. Chairs, small tables, and even some art on the walls all struck oddly conversant tones, looking like pieces from my own home. But this wasn't my home, and whatever charade my captors were putting on wasn't working. I just had to focus. Just had to remember where I was going and what awaited me there. I just needed to keep my mind trained on winning my freedom, and soon I would be home again, able to heal and to think once more. One sluggish and labored step forward followed the last, each one resulting in more of a shuffle and slide of my feet with every passing inch. As I came across a pair of chairs sat opposite sides of a small end table, I nearly fell to the floor attempting to navigate around them, with the available handholds and support suddenly made more difficult but by the few extra inches of space. I may have sank into the chair to take a rest. I may not have. The memory of it is made fuzzy and difficult to recall with clarity. Undoubtedly the result of this hell I've been stuck in wearing down my mental faculties. If I did, I know for certain that I rose again and continued down the corridor. At the end, there was a small staircase that led downward. I had come to do deuce over time that I was on the second floor of whatever this place was, and that, logically, there should be an exit somewhere at the bottom of those steps. I only had to make it there and down, which I knew would be a challenge unto itself, but one I would rise to meet when I made it to the end. My feet shambled one after another, and my sense of balance began to tip. I felt myself begin to, as well, but managed to steady myself against the wall. Whatever they had done to me, they had done it thoroughly, as my conscious thinking mind was as dizzy and out of order as my motor function was. I attempted to shake off the listing feeling, but doubled down on my focus as much as possible, simply compensating by leaning heavier on my hand as it slid along the wall for some form of purchase. To my good fortune, I managed to make it all the way down the hall, leaning finally against the frame to a closed door just across the way from the top of the stairs. This would certainly be a dangerous descent, but it was made more difficult by the distance between my position and the top of the banister. I would need to walk roughly 3 to 4 paces to cross the hall, all without support. While on any other day this would have been no problem, here it was bound to be a more daring sort of operation. Counting to 3, I readied myself as much as possible before pushing off the doorframe and shuffling into the middle of the hall. I was 3 steps away from the stairwell, and then 2. Finally, a single step remained, and as I crossed that ground, my hands reached out almost in a panic before finding the hard, smooth, polished wood of the well-stained banister. I felt as though I could collapse in that moment, but that innate drive within me to return to my family pushed me onward. I gazed down the wooden stairs as they circled downward along the adjacent walls. I should, I reasoned, manage to conserve enough strength on the way down so long as I keep myself stable and take my time. I could even take a seat on the steps if my energy ran dry too quickly. Or even on that same token, simply sit and slide myself down step by step until I reached the bottom. Though getting back on my feet could prove to be another daunting challenge at the end of that pain, it was nothing my resolve could not overcome, regardless how weak and withered I felt. I took a deep breath and prepared to begin my descent. Though what should be a casual jaunt down a simple flight of stairs could take 10 or even 20 minutes at my current pace, I knew that so long as I remained motivated, attentive, and most importantly, quiet, I would be free in effectively no time at all. And then I heard them. "What are you doing?" they barked, as they, the one in red and one of the regular in-house prison guards, came barreling down the hall. I was caught. There were no two ways about it. I looked down the stairs, wondering if I would manage to make it out if I merely hurled myself down them in some fashion. Perhaps having to deal with a cracked rib or mild concussion, while I forced my achy bones and sinews to propel me out of this place and back into the world. Surely, if some passerby outside, a pedestrian, or even a motorist, saw what a terrible state I was in, limping down the street outside, someone would stop to help me. But before I could even come to the natural conclusion that this was a bad idea that wouldn't work out at all on my own, 2 pairs of strong hands again gripped my arms and shoulders, pulling me back from the banister. I attempted to keep a grip as they did, but it was of no use. As usual, they were simply too strong for me, and as they pulled me back, I felt my legs give out, and I quickly crumpled into their waiting arms. I was lifted like a sack of potatoes, like a large piece of beef, like a corpse. My vision, or my memory, Or both. Go in and out at that point. Though I both know and can recall being carried back down the hall. Back to this room. Back to my prison. I recall finding it almost interesting how long a trek getting down the hall had felt compared to how quickly and without issue being carried back up it did. That was to the best of my recollection, the closest I've come to escape, just yet. They keep the door closed when not in the room with me now, and unfortunately seem to make checking in on me and asking me questions a more frequent occurrence. And always, still with the questions. For some reason, they seem very intent on learning about my children. They ask what their names are, how old they are, where they are. They ask me trick questions, such as if I remember things which I know didn't happen, or conversations I know never took place. I can't help but think it's all part of their plan to wear me down. I've toyed with the idea of playing into their little games, to answer and agree with them whenever they come to interrogate me. Play the helpful hostage. Fake a little Stockholm syndrome, and hopefully convince them to drop their guard again. I can almost recall how far it was to the steps, and can almost remember how many steps there seemed to be. 14, or was it 16? In any event, I know now that my greatest asset is patience. I haven't had much, but I can improve on that. I'll smile at the increasingly strange visitors who push their drugs and questions on me. I'll make them drop their guard, and when they do, I'll be ready. They all tend to look different now. Stranger, in a sense. Their faces, if you can call them that, appear like vague blurs on the front of their heads. Familiar, somewhat. Human-esque, I might call them. It isn't consistent, but then again, nothing in this place is. They all insist I know them. They say as much verbatim almost every time I object to whatever it is they're trying to do, or to who it is they insist they are. It's an underhanded and craven strategy they employ. They'll come in. They'll sit with their blurry faces and mystery identities. Dope me up to get me talking about my kids and then some. Finish up by trying to convince me that they are my children. This sort of insanity offends me. I can't make out exactly who they are, but I can be sure of who they aren't. My children are still in their 20s, whereas these people are all clearly well into middle age. It could be that whoever they are believe that if they can break me to the point I'll accept their lies as truth, that after that they'll be able to program me to believe anything. But I'm not falling for it. I won't. I can't fall for it. There's too much riding on me, and too many people depending on me out there. I play as nice as I can, humoring them in the hopes they'll inadvertently afford me another opportunity to escape. One I will not fail at, now knowing where I have to go and how I plan to get there. It's just down the hallway, just on the left. Or was it the right? In any event, it doesn't matter. All that matters is that I bide my time, force my smiles, answer their questions, even if only with lies, and wait. The right time will arise. It has to. When it does, I will be ready. I will not be stopped. I will walk out of this place on my own. I will drink a cold beer. I will eat a red steak. I will wake with the sunrise and sleep through the night with them all in the right order. I'll ask my own questions. I'll find out who these people are and what they are doing with me. I'll expose them to the world and see to it no one ever has to suffer through this again. And most importantly, and above all else, I will be with my boys and my precious little girl again. I will go home. I will stay home. I will be free. Down the hall, a conversation was being held. It was grim, as they all had been, and none involved seemed to be finding them any easier the more frequently they had them. It was Sam who spoke first.
"He really isn't getting any better,"
he said to his siblings, as the three sat around a coffee table, an obvious and heavy foreboding shared between them. "This really isn't the kind of thing one gets better from, Sam," Oliver replied.
"It's like he doesn't even know who we are," Sam lamented.
"He doesn't. He doesn't even know he's in his own home. It isn't that he's forgotten us. He knows who his kids are. He just doesn't recognize us as being them,"
Sherry clarified sadly.
"Maybe some memory exercises?" Sam said, almost pleadingly.
Sherry glanced to Oliver and simply shook her head as he cast his eyes downward.
"We're way past that now, Sam. This is... this is going to be him for the rest of his life. However long that might be,"
she explained.
"But just the other day, he seemed like his old self. Or at least a little bit like it. He even recognized me,"
Sam protested. "Yeah, and those days will be fewer and further between. This is how it all works, brother. It was the same with Caroline's mom. She had good days, then she had increasingly more bad days. Right up until... well, until the end," Oliver replied, drawing sadly from previous experience as he watched with his wife as her mother slowly succumbed to that which was now consuming his father. Tears welled in his eyes as he finished his sentence. The three sat in silence for a few moments, none really sure what to say next, if anything at all. All three had watched their father's decline over the past year, and Sherry and Sam had, within the past 6 months, moved back into the family home so as to care for him as his condition got worse. Though care options, through assisted living and nursing facilities, were both available and affordable, thanks to their dad having been remarkably good with his money over the years, the trio agreed that it was likely best he remain at home, surrounded by familiar faces and things. But especially in the last week, all familiarity seemed to have escaped the old man. His favorite visiting nurse, Wendy, who always arrived sporting her bright red nurse's scrubs, had suddenly become a stranger to him. His three grown children, who were now tending to him around the clock likewise, were no longer recognizable to him.
His decline had worsened to the point where all involved knew it was only a matter of time before the end came. It would all be over soon. And then, a whole new fresh hell of pain was in store. However, at least there would be finality. The siblings reasoned to themselves and each other. Heading into their father's room, Sherry, Sam, and Oliver all took seats around the hospital bed in which he lay. To their surprise, it seemed as though he was actually having a good day that day. A considerable change from the previous day, when their stubborn old dad managed to shuffle down the hall and nearly fell down the stairs. He had been irritable and confused for the entire week. So as the three sat around him, they were all rather relieved to see him smile warmly at the sight of them. For a moment, as he greeted them, though not by name, it felt as though they had their good old dad back once again. They sat together and chatted, reminiscing on days gone by. Happier times. Better times. Their father would be gone soon. It was just a matter of time. It was inevitable. They all knew it. But for the time they had remaining, the three all meant to cherish those final days together. They loved their dad. So much so, they just couldn't let him go.
I hope you enjoyed They Will Not Let Me Go, as written by Nick Goroff and performed by Nick Goroff and Rissa Montanez. Voice actor and 2016 Evil Idol champion Nick Goroff's talents can be found on our very own Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, as well as on past episodes of the Simply Scary podcast. You can also join Nick on his YouTube channel, Wizard of Cause.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Our second tale of the evening is written by J.R. Hamatashen. So without any further ado, I present to you Rococo Veins and Lurid Stains.
I walk to the window as swiftly as I can without drawing attention to myself. I don't want to alert my parents to what's going on. There's no point. Scaring my family needlessly won't do anything. No one would know what happened. I could tell them now what might happen, but why? Who would believe me? I would just die in my sleep, I guess, and that'd be it. Kristen killed herself, they'd say. And in a way, they wouldn't be wrong. It's what I'd wanted. I hoped that's what my father and mother and brother would eventually settle on. I should write a note. Tell them that I chose to kill myself. That it wasn't their fault, that I know they tried their best. It's the best I could really do for them. I wanted to die, but I never wanted to make my family suffer. They didn't do anything wrong, or at least they didn't do anything uniquely wrong. Nothing any more wrong than all human beings can't help but do. Sure, they were selfish and entitled and ignorant and oblivious, but no more than any other middle-class suburban family. There are millions of families like that, and they don't all have defective daughters who choose death. I look out the window and I see Aaron. At least, that's what he told me his name was. Although, I guess he didn't have any reason to lie about his name. He still looks to be about my age, so that's consistent from the first time I met him. His black, greasy hair is arched diagonally over his eyes. His eyes are intense, lit by a dark fire. He has raccoon eyes. I can tell this even though, by all appearances, he's all the way by the curb on the other side of the street, and I'm staring out my ground floor living room window. I'm a normal girl with normal vision, 20/20 when squinting. I shouldn't be able to see him so vividly. The only reason I'm able to is because he's allowing me to. No, more like making me see him. Am I supposed to be intimidated? He waves his right hand. His long-sleeved flannel shirt is rolled up so I can see his wrists, even though it's dusk out and he appears far away. I shouldn't be able to see them so clearly. I see the lurid stain on his right wrist. The hand jerks harshly, and the skin of his wrist tears back like the peel of a banana. I can hear the snap that exists only for me. I see the sharp, multicolored brambles inside his wrist, rising steadily and spreading outward, that make me think of an accelerated time lapse of crops growing in a field. Rococo veins. That's a term Aaron had used to describe his exposed gore. Beautiful, like prickly shrubs made of bone and blood. He told me that phrase, rococo veins, the second time I'd met him, when he was still trying to impress me with our shared morbid sense of humor. I love decadent words and expressions like that. Rococo veins and lurid stains. Sounds like a band I'd love unabashedly for a bit, and then feel deeply embarrassed about once I went off to college and matured in the way people are expected to. I didn't really even know what that word rococo meant, but his injuries were such an enticing combination of gross and sad that I just couldn't look away, like an exposed wrist full of car crashes. Or maybe, if I'm being honest, I was really scared, too. Both scared and fascinated. He was a pretentious dick, I now realize, but a charming dick. And I'd been too fascinated to do anything other than agree. I felt I was doing him a favor. I suppose I was. I suppose I am, still. He seems really eager, I tell myself. Who am I fooling? He was probably a pretentious dick in real life, which makes me feel really sad and pissed. It's like giving your virginity to someone, and even though you enjoyed it too, you wonder if that was a gift that should have been saved for someone, I don't know, more worthy? Then again, I'm a pretentious fool too, aren't I? So why all the hate? Stop thinking the worst of people. There's no point now. I breathe heavily and head down for dinner with my entire family. The gang's all here. My father, mother, and brother all looking at me funny. What else is new? They look at me with worry, constant worry. And it's been so satisfying to rail against them all, tell them to stop worrying about me. But they'd been right to worry about me, weren't they? I look at my mother and am reminded of how much we look alike. We share the same mousy brown hair, same flat nose, and too large forehead. I get my large breasts from her, too, although she doesn't call them that. She refers to them when we've gone bra shopping as our heavy build or something like that. When you're a suburban mom, you can't just acknowledge you have big tits. You have to refer to them as something else. That type of language is for kids who get in trouble. I can look at my mother and think about what I'd look like when I get older. And I know I'll never get older. And I want to cry. I want to cry, and I should. I should share this one great cry with them all, but if I do that, then they'll spend the rest of their lives thinking that this was the last warning sign, that they should have done something to save me. But they can't. I'm beyond saving. It's the greatest, what is that, irony? I'd have a greater irony than any of those O. Henry stories I had to write about in English class. I wanted to die until the very moment I agreed to do so. It was unbelievable, really. I've tried to kill myself twice. My parents only know about the second time. The first time was 92 days ago. Funny, I think life is valueless, yet I kept track of my attempt to end it. If life is valueless, then shouldn't my attempt to end it also be valueless? Anyway, I tried to slit my wrist. Not knowing exactly how to do it, and maybe not researching it as a way to subconsciously sabotage my attempt, I made one clean slash too far up on my arm. It hurt like hell, but had no chance of doing any permanent damage, other than leaving a vicious scar. Really, I slashed my lower forearm rather than my wrist. I immediately got a towel and put pressure on the wound and ran down the block to Eliza's to bandage myself up. I maybe could have bled out and died, I suppose, so I count that as a suicide attempt. Eliza wanted to die too, and she had a mixture of concern, awe, and resentment that I'd made such an overt attempt. She thought I'd wait for her, although she's all talk. Then the funny argument that followed about whether I cut my upper forearm or my lower forearm had me in stitches. And yes, that was a pun we'd made and further laughed about. It all depended on your perspective. The area near the wrist is the lower forearm if you think your arm starts at your shoulder. It's the upper forearm if you think your arm begins at your hand. That stupid argument, both of us being so stubborn, Eliza maybe being ultra animated to get over her shock about the whole situation, and me being ultra goofy because of my blood loss. All that kind of made me want to go on living. Just the sublime silliness of it. You live for moments like that. We later settled the question about what consists the upper versus the lower forearm by looking it up on Google, and the conclusiveness of the answer kind of sapped my good mood. It made me sad. I know, so dramatic. Like the availability of information is a bad thing. It felt like a closed door, just more mystery lost. The silly argument about the forearm with my equally silly friend had made me feel like a naive child again. And that's a feeling I'm nostalgic for. So, being the pathetic baby I am and still in low spirits about Google having robbed me of the joys of ignorance, I stole, only 4 days after my first suicide attempt, 10 sleeping pills from my mom and downed them with some swigs of purloined Jack Daniels from my parents' liquor cabinet. Purloined. I like that word. I like words. I don't want to think about things I like anymore. Good thing we're eating chicken cutlets with mashed potatoes for dinner. I'm tired of chicken cutlets and I hate mashed potatoes. Think about that. Concentrate on the things you hate. It was stupid to steal the Jack Daniels. If I hadn't taken the Jack, I'd probably be dead. It was the smell of alcohol that tipped my mom off that something was amiss. She checked on me and found me unconscious. So I got my stomach pumped and had to endure tepid jokes from kids at school when word spread. Eliza was worried for me. Her enthusiasm for killing herself seemed to be gone, and she was in a tough position because her mom instructed her not to associate with me anymore, which, of course, is the most selfish thing ever. I mean, your daughter's friend is hurting and you order your daughter to shun that friend? What a horrible person. Eliza's mother was always a cunt. No wonder Eliza had the problem she had. Although, like, I'm one to talk. Things like that, though, make me want to keep on living just to correct people's terrible fucking opinions and advice. People can be such assholes. I've been in counseling ever since the second attempt. My parents never let me out of their sight. Even my shithead brother, when he talks to me, is unfailingly nice. But none of it worked. I don't want to live anymore. That's just the way it is. That's what I decided. Aaron remembers screaming. It hurt so badly. I remember looking at my wrists and thinking how selfish and stupid I am. How crazy I am. Why am I doing this? My poor mother. My poor mother. I feel so badly for her. That's even worse than the pain, somehow. I remember thinking, I'm dying. I'm dying? I'm dying. I thought before, I'll show them. But then it was, I'm dying, I'm dying, I'm dying. Like when you have the flu and your brain is infected with macabre thoughts. When you're dying, your brain goes into manic overdrive. I saw the blood as life. I saw it gushing out of me and I thought how fucking stupid I was. I thought life was pointless and worthless, and I always had a flair for the melodramatic, so I kept burying myself more and more in that idea that people are so stupid, that life is so worthless, how I'll show them, I'll get back at them, and lacking the ambition to blow everyone up, I sat in the tub and gashed open my wrists. And as I saw that blood pour out of me, I realized how wrong I was about everything. Like this was getting back at anyone. Like they'd care. Please, God, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean this. I need to take it back. My wrist burns in a terrible way. In an unalterable way. Mom. Mom, you don't deserve this. I saw her face, but even that's robbed from me because as I was dying, my memories of her were being distorted. I saw red behind my eyes, so her face was blindingly red, like staring directly at the rising sun and dripping gloopy. What did I think this would be? Did I think I'd gain some insight? The mole on my mother's face, the thing I so cruelly associated her with, was the only thing I could see through the river of red that overtook her face. The mole is the only thing peeking above the lake of blood I saw before me. I didn't want to close my eyes, but I couldn't help it. I became so hot and exhausted. It was all the blood loss. I'm so sorry. Even in death, I didn't do you justice. I made an unwitting mockery of you. Your only son and I do this. My last thought was wondering if I'd shit myself. If it'd get stuck inside me, like when you find a mouse caught in a glue trap, gnawed off limbs, clogged bowels. God, how awful. There's no tragic nobility in this. I don't deserve you. And now I've left you. Please, 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 please. Not like this. I didn't want to live anymore, I decided. I'd gotten so low that I couldn't be convinced otherwise. Of course, I'd tell the counselor my parents sent me to that I was making progress, made sure to give the appearance of dips and valleys, a real erstwhile effort. But the issue had already been resolved. I chose death. Then, they all came to me. I'd say it was a dream, but it wasn't. I wasn't in bed, I wasn't sleeping. It was like, if this makes any sense, like telemarketers, almost. So many offers came, whizzed by. So much static chatter in the air. I felt their presence, but only some could, it seemed, slow down to make an impression on me. Life is a limited resource, I learned. Life was wasted on the living, one of them said, which I found clever. I think it was Aaron. If I decided I really wanted to die, why not give another the gift of rebirth? There was the college girl from Columbus who stole her father's handgun and blew her brains out. She realized that she wanted to return to kill her ex-girlfriend. I didn't want to encourage murder, so she was out. Then there was the girl from near Cincinnati who went to a Catholic prep school who hung herself. God, how petty will this sound? But I blew her off because I didn't want to help a girl from Cincinnati. My father grew up in Cleveland and hates the Cincinnati Bengals. Yeah, I'm a girl who says fuck the world, but I still want to make my daddy proud by not helping someone because she had the misfortune of killing herself in a rival football team's region. Plus, I told myself that hanging yourself, especially inside a Catholic school, was too self-indulgently dramatic. The petty narcissism of the narcissistically suicidal. Also, I felt bad for the unknowing janitor who found her. Then, there was the boy who looked a couple years younger than me. Maybe he was as young as 13 even. He cried and cried. He had these terrible, burnt, crusty-looking strawberry facial scars lined with this kind of rancid-looking pus. They reminded me of exploded strawberry Pop-Tarts, like some terrible blend of both the red insides and the dotted sugary frosting all combined and seared on this poor kid's face. I felt terrible for him. I think he was Albanian or Polish or something. All I know is that we didn't understand each other. He was shy, even in death, ashamed of his inability to communicate. I tried to ask him about his scars and meant to say pus-y, like it looks like pus, but said pussy, and I giggled, and he didn't. How alienated and alone must a teenage boy be to not laugh at the word pussy? But he didn't catch it or understand. He seemed to be in terrible pain, but I couldn't understand him, so I don't know how to explain it, but I broke the connection. I liked Aaron, though. Maybe it was like Goldilocks. The Albanian had been too young, the college girl too old, the hanged girl too much of a bitch, I thought. But Aaron was just right, or right enough. He had a flair for sophisticated drama like me, and he said all the right things about his mother, about needing to go back and help his single mother who was all alone without him because of his rash decision. He acted like he was torn. On one hand, life wasn't worth living, but on the other, he should have made sure his mom was taken care of before parting this mortal coil. I remember he said this, moral coil, and I found it endearing that he was trying to sound smart, but fucked it up. He had scars on his wrists, and I showed him my forearm scar, and we both treated this like we were showing off earned war wounds that should come with a Purple Heart or something. How stupid, I know. I told him about my clumsy attempt and shared the upper forearm versus lower forearm anecdote. He'd agreed with my analysis, and I liked him. I felt like I didn't want my life anymore, and I was just wasting it, so why not do a good deed and give him my life force so he could come back and make things right? Everything was such a blur. There was so much, I don't know, clamoring in my head. It was like after I decided that I wanted to die, I got this, like, just flood of noise and requests. I wanted that to end, but it wouldn't. Aaron got lucky when he visited me for the second time. It was perfect timing, for his purposes anyway. He visited me while I was sitting in the waiting room of that quack therapist, Miss or Dr. Gottesman, or whatever she called herself. I'm someone who tried to kill herself, and that bitch is taking time out of my therapy session to correct me when I said Ms. instead of Doctor. I mean, hello, I tried to kill myself here. I think we have more important things to concentrate on here. I hated her so much that I thought I'd love to be a patient of hers and kill myself, let myself be a black mark on her record. So as I sat listlessly in the waiting room, stewing in anger, just anticipating her stupid, pushy face, I agreed to forfeit my life for Aaron. It would be painless, seamless, and I agreed to forfeit myself later that night. That was yesterday. It's the strangest thing. Today at school, I watched the cafeteria staff, people I never really paid attention to at all, or when I'd really noticed them in the past, it was usually with mild condescension, you know? Like these poor, uneducated people, you know? Like a mix of condescension and pity, making slave wages or whatever. But today, I watched them serve the kids, run around in the back and grab drinks and toast bread, and just the kind of camaraderie there. White and black and Latino people all working together. And I found it pretty beautiful, in a way. They seemed satisfied doing their tasks. I imagined the logistics of it all, imagined what it would be like if I were in charge of the cafeteria operations, and that would be something I'd enjoy. Planning things out, the inventory, doing a job together with others, making cafeteria lunch, something I never thought about before. And I now had a new perspective on it, on all the other little mundane things in the world. There was something really noble about all the world's little tasks. Now that I knew my life was ending, everything became so overwhelmingly, like, imbued with meaning. A rush of other buzzing voices came to me today, all wanting me to sign their dotted lines, so to speak. "No, me. No, me. I deserve it more," they said in their various ways. "No, it's really me who needs to come back, for whatever reason." They told me that Aaron lied to me. "You don't come back as who you were before, for obvious reasons. You probably come back as something else, and it's doubtful you'd have any real memory of who you were before." Even the Albanian kid with the gruesome, encrusted burn came back around and made impassioned gestures that I assume were about what Aaron had told me. So, Aaron's claim he needed to come back to help his suffering mother was a lie, because he wouldn't come back as Aaron at all. Or maybe he didn't know, I told myself. Maybe he meant he'd come back as someone else and find his mother and help her without knowing it was really her reincarnated son. I didn't believe that myself. When you're dedicated to something like coming back to life, I think you know the basics. I could back out, I thought, although, of course, I don't really know the rules about this. Last night, I didn't go to sleep, and I just filled my head with as many images of being closed off as I could. Doors shutting, locked vaults, sealed manholes. I don't know, I just remember my agreement with Aaron had so much flowery-feeling language about opening myself up to him that I figured the opposite thoughts would keep him out. I don't know if it worked, but I'm still here. But I can't stay awake forever. Now Aaron is sitting next to me at our dinner table. So strange. This is a small table with only room for the four of us. What chair can he be sitting on? Did he bring his own chair? Is it a ghost chair? That's the kind of person I am. I notice the telling detail. It's something I like about myself. Strange. I don't hate myself. I wanted to die, but I never hated myself. Rather, I hated other people and wanted out of this endless rat race. I wonder if my tendency to notice strange things will carry on to wherever I go after all this. I see Aaron's smudged ink raccoon eyes, his melodramatic angular hair, his flannel shirt, his alabaster skin that is now swirling with a sort of showy, angry rouge. I look down at his wrists and they're gushing blood, just insane amounts. Like his wrists are angry at me and this is their version of yelling. I don't understand so much of this. Why he's dressed at all? Why he's looking so angrily at me? Maybe he's angry because he's afraid I gave him some kind of false hope, and now I'm trying to, what's the phrase from business class? Something like, renege on the deal? My family doesn't see any of this. They don't see the angry dead boy pouring curdled blood on the floor by the gallonful. Only I see it. Which I suppose means, maybe it isn't there. Who am I fooling? I hear a kind of howling outside my house. It has the cutting force of gusting wind, but there's more to it than that. There's like a chorus of howls.
You hear that? That's all the competition out there. If you think I'm being annoying, just imagine how bad they're gonna be once they get their hands on you.
And it was true, I knew. I imagined the strawberry-scarred Albanian boy out there screaming, the Cincinnati prep school girl with her fat blue eel of a tongue sticking out all crooked, groaning at me as best she could, given her circumstances, and all the other spirits out there. A whole army of dead, angry kids closing in on me. Maybe it's like a satellite, and when I told myself definitively that I wanted to die, the spirits nearest to me heard the message. Now the word is spread that I was receptive to giving my wasted life to another, and the hungry herd has come to lick the plate clean.
I know you probably think I'm an asshole. I'm not. We made a deal, and if this were any other deal, I'd understand if you wanted to back out. But this is different. We made a deal, and you're doing a good thing. Just let me in, and it will be entirely painless, I promise. Let's just get it over with, friend.
He seemed genuine, a bit like he did the first time we met. But I detected a subtle threat underlying all that. Why all the theatrics, then? Why the pouring blood? Why the rouge face, if not to intimidate me? Or maybe that's just who he was, a melodramatic look-at-me boy. I got the feeling he was enjoying the allure of success, of getting his way. It's the kids who feel the world owes them something who most abuse any newfound power. That's real profound, isn't it? I'm just chock full of wisdom. All for nothing now, I suppose. I don't express this, but I'm afraid that somehow he'll hurt my family. I agree to go upstairs with him and excuse myself from the dining room. I wanted to say something to my parents, but couldn't without alarming them needlessly. What could they do? I politely put my dishes away, food half-eaten, and said I just wasn't feeling very hungry. I smiled gamely at them, and it was heartbreaking, because the smile was genuine. I saw my mother and father and brother as damaged, but ultimately good people, just trying their best under the circumstances. I love them. Maybe that's a type of closure. Or maybe it's the love you feel when you know you're never going to see someone again. Love is an easy emotion, then, when it's consequenceless. See, I can ruin everything. As I get up and walk, I see Aaron in my peripheral vision following me, and he's too jaunty, too self-satisfied. That hurts me the most somehow. Like he's getting something over on me. Like even if it was something you wanted to do, the other person's insistence makes you think you're getting a raw deal. Like I'm being had. I get the terrible feeling like I'm interested in a boy and I want him to like me, so I'm agreeing to go upstairs and let him feel me up, or maybe suck him off. But as I stand up, I just grow to detest how smug and satisfied and excited he is about it. Like he won and I'm the sucker. All of that was part of why I wanted to kill myself in the first place. And to think, even on the brink of death, it's the same thing. The greatest horror of it all might be that the afterlife is full of the same frustrating, terrible shit as real life. It never ends. I go upstairs and I don't know what to do. Maybe reason with him? Deep down, he seems like a good guy, really. That's why I agreed to do this at all. Maybe I can reason with him. Or I can scream. Maybe if I just draw attention to myself, it can help things, delay things. Maybe the voices outside will rush in. I started to speak and he's disappearing inside me and I feel a fullness in my head and chest. There's too much life here. There's something inside me. It's a war in here, in my faculties. This place is too full. I'm too full. I see myself outside myself. I sense myself being carried away. And I don't feel any pain. I awake, startled. I look at my wrists, so afraid they'd be torn open, but they look fine, of course. That woman who I dreamed was my mother, she seems so real, so strange. I remember that woman I dreamed was my mother had a mole on her face, but that's the only detail I remember upon waking. But that will fade. If I told my mother I dreamed she had a mole on her face, she'd be pissed. I'm trying to laugh off the frightening dream, but layered beneath is the fear that this isn't normal. Like there was too much to that nightmare for it to be something I can just shrug off. But that's just how dreams are, and I'm sensitive. I've always been extremely sensitive. In fact, I just know there has to be more to these persistent dreams. I'd been a despondent teenage boy. Aaron, not even close to my real name, and I'd read somewhere that names or smells are almost impossible to experience or recall from a dream. I died somehow, this dream Aaron. Blood pouring out of me, so hot, I remember. It's also visceral. Guilt over a depressed, middle-aged woman all alone somewhere that I need to save, that I owe something to. My mother, I dreamed. My mother is just fine. And if there was something wrong with her, I'm sure she'd be the first to tell me. Just stay positive, breathe deep, and drink some water. I'll get over it.
I hope you enjoyed Rococo Veins and Lurid Stains, as written by Horror Hill favorite J.R. Hamantaschen. Acclaimed throughout the underground horror world, J.R. Hamantaschen's stories push the boundaries and refuse to conform to usual conventions. A mix of nihilism, cosmic horror, and weird fiction, this collection is a must-read for anyone who craves the dark and disturbing. Following in the footsteps of H.P. Lovecraft, Thomas Ligotti, T.E.D. Klein, and Dennis Etchison, Hamantaschen masterfully weaves tales of horror that articulate what we've always suspected, that life is a losing proposition. On to the shows. Longtime resident and powerhouse, Otis Gyre has his very own show here on our network, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which you can hear every Sunday night. And please be sure to check out the other shows we offer on our network. We have Fear from the Heartland, featuring horror stories brought to you from the Heartland, airing Wednesdays. Eric Peabody's Horror Hill is a podcast dedicated to some of our deeper and darker tales. We hope you check him out. And Drew Blood's Dark Tales airs Fridays, featuring some southern down-home horror. Now, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us for tonight and remind you to take a moment to stop by our iTunes page and please leave Chilling Tales for Dark Nights a 5-star review and a kind word. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram if you haven't already. And of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012. And consider signing up as a patron at our website, chillingtalesfordarknights.com, to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. I'm your host of the evening, Steve Taylor, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.